Shiv Dasani Fellow for this term, who's going to be offering a series of readings in the Upanishads, which we're going to be just going
And emphasise readings.
Readings, okay. Yeah. We were just going to read the Sanskrit text together, and I thought there'd be about five people.
And I prepared for that, you know.
So I'm very, very pleased that so many of you have turned up. I don't think he needs any introductions. Patrick is very well renowned, very famous. He's done his translated the Upanishads, and he's now working on the Dharma Shastras, and he's done a lot of work on the Ashrama system and so on. I'm sure you're all very familiar with his work. So I just hand us over to his capable hands, Patrick.
Yes, after having castigated you and told you don't come again.
We probably need more photocopies.
Right, yeah, and I thought I had... And I must also apologize because Upanishads I worked on intensely for maybe 7-8 years or 10 years or whatever. And now for the last 10 years I have not been working on it. So I'm as rusty as you all are about it because I have now turned to the legal side of it, of Sanskrit texts, and I'm working on the Dharma Shastras. So here's some that you all may want to... Anybody doesn't have that? I thought all of you... I'm today trying to work on a study that I did way back when, I'm not sure when. This doesn't have a... Sometime in the... Oh, yeah, 1999. So this is a late 1990s. Mm-hmm. Okay, more coming. Okay, so basically, I'm trying to work through this article that I wrote as, you know, something that derived from my translation of the Upanishads. Let me then, when I got the bad news yesterday that there'll be a lot of people here, when I talked with Sangyutta and I knew that others would be coming, I sort of tried to say, what am I going to say now, you know, as, rather than read the... So I
know nothing.
You know, you know everything, Sangyukta. So what I thought was maybe give a little bit of a introduction to what I was trying to do with this text. This is the Shweta Ketu story. Shweta Ketu interested me because he's a interesting young man, he doesn't occupy as famous a position in the early hagiographies of India as, for example, Yajnavalkya does. But he's interesting because he's colorful. And he has an afterlife after the Upanishads, which I sort of gathered in the postscript of this a little bit, right? but he makes appearances twice in the Chandogya and Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. And as well as Kaushitiki. Once in this famous story that this study is based on, when he goes to meet a king who is named in the Brihadaranyaka and the Chandogya as Jaivali, and in the Kaushitiki version as Chitra. So it's sort of, the names are different. And then again, as the young student, taught by his father Uddalaka Aruni in the 6th chapter of the Chandogya. There he's rather, his character is not developed, he's just a guy, you know, who's hanging around and becomes the sort of the vehicle through which Uddalaka is teaching this. So he's there, it's not, his character doesn't come out. But I think in this story of his encounter with the king, it does. So that's sort of my the focus of this study. But just to backtrack a little bit, the way the Upanishads have been studied in the past, and still to some degree, they are studied for their content. What is their philosophy? What are they trying to say? Either for historical purposes, you know, for historians of culture and ideas of ancient India, or for people who are trying to derive some personal benefit, you know, from it, like people who are theologians, for example, or practitioners. So just like people go to the Bible, for example, you know, for those two kinds of. So in a sense, what we have, and especially in the 19th century and early 20th, Western scholarship has been especially focused on finding what is the oldest. And this started with the discovery of Sanskrit and the whole Aryan thesis, you know, and to some degree has much to do with the Europeans' desire to find their own roots than anything that India may have to offer, right? So it is a complicated psychohistory, I think, of the 19th century that, you know, went up to the Nazi period and all of that, you know, so that we don't have to worry about. But this textual archaeology that we all have engaged in, you know, as scholars, nothing to be sneezed at, you know, I do it myself, and to some degree this is derived from, I think, and similar to the biblical studies, you know, that we have, you know, when take the Pentateuch and all the J, the source criticisms and all of that that we have, it's very, very familiar. But I think, at least in the United States, biblical studies took a different turn, and an interesting turn, in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, to looking at the Bible as literature. And not looking at what went behind, but taking it and looking at it in its or in the way it is constituted now, and that has, you know, with the culture studies and literary theories and all of that, has taken on a very, very sophisticated turn in the United States, and I'm neither competent, I don't have the, you know, ability or the knowledge to undertake that kind of study, you know, because I don't have that skills. But I became interested in looking at the Upanishads as a piece of literature. Then you ask different kinds of questions, rather than the other way of studying them, and to try to find out how the ways the authors use language effectively, either to communicate for aesthetic reasons. And as I've tried to show here, we can also find out a little bit of their what they're trying to do with the story, especially when it is a story that is well known. For example, just like the old Kavyas in India, the stories were known, right? There's no novels in India. In other words, you create a story, right? That for ancient India would have thought, you know, as a strange enterprise, you know, that you would concoct a story. So you take a story that is already well known, it's the way you tell it that makes the beauty, you know. So in a sense, so the language is so important, you know, the way you tell the story. And that, I think, is true also in the Upanishads, you know. My good friend Stephanie Jameson, whom probably you all know, spent some time in Oxford also, I think, a few years ago. Talking about philology, which is now often a bad word in these days of post-colonial, you know, whatever, you know, has spoken about the courtesy we owe to people in the past of knowing their language. Just like anthropologists have to have the courtesy of going somewhere and talking to those people in their own language, you know, and then the courtesy of reading what they have written closely, intently, and what we call close reading, as opposed to a pure theory of, you know, whatever knowledge that we may have. And this is what I call philology. You know, that's what we call philology. I mean, philology has many aspects, but one is this close reading of it, and that's what I'm trying to do here. Looking at what philology can achieve through close reading, my, you know, colleague at University of Texas, Joel Brereton, who knows much more about Upanishads than I do, and we should bring him down here to talk about the Upanishads than I, and has written extensively on the Upanishads, especially taking the literary functions and philology very closely. He has written a wonderful article on the dialogue between Yajnavalkya and Maitreyi, his wife, which occurs twice in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. And because Brihadaranyaka has two recensions, you know, Kanva and the Madhyandina, so basically we have four versions of the same story, which is very interesting, you know, how the same story has been told four times. And it's a very interesting study, and showing also a kind of verse that underlies this prose. It seems that there was what we would call today, I guess, blank or free verse. It scans, sort of, you know, it's not real. And he has shown the underlying verse that is. So I think philology can achieve all of that. So with that sort of background, I think I want to come to the Shvetaketu Jaivali story, which again is interesting because it's repeated three times in different ways. Once in the Brihadaranyaka, once in the Chandogya, and once in the Kaushitiki Upanishads. Kaushitiki is very brief, and we'll see that all three here. This story contains the famous doctrine of the five fires, which is the first time that the theory of rebirth at some level is given a full explanation in the Upanishads. It's sort of referred to in the Yajnavalkya dialogue, and where he takes, what's his name, out and says, you know, this is a secret, and you know, people become as they act here. It's very, very murky, brief reference. Besides that, here this is the longest we have. So it has been studied quite a lot. Cernan Renata, who teaches at SOAS, has written possibly the most detailed article on this story. Bodewitz from Leiden has also worked on the Panchagni Vidya. But their analysis, for the most part, is trying to find out what is the oldest. Where in these stories are the kernel of what went earliest. I'm not excited by that, because what do you do after you find it? You know, even if you find it. And Renu has worked on this and basically said it is impossible to find what is the oldest, for the simple reason that you often bring subjective biases. So there's no objective criterion by which you can say this is older than that. Just because the language is archaic doesn't mean that it necessarily is older, right? Archaisms, we know, are always used. Bhagavata Purana has archaisms, right? Which are very, very old, which appear to be old. So there's nothing I think we can really... So it has been studied, but not in the way that I wanted to study. And I want to study in this one, especially the way the authors try to depict this young man, Shvetaketu. And that's sort of the focus of the study, but it has other aspects of storytelling and how language is used, I think, by the respective authors. But one thing that we come up when we say the language of the author is who are the authors? And that's not very clear. Because in all likelihood, all the Upanishads, especially the longer ones, Brihadaranyaka and Chandogya, were anthologies. And when it's an anthology, I mean, today, we would look at an anthology and analyze it very differently than a text. Anthology, you ask, you know, who made the anthology, first of all, and secondly, what were the criteria by which certain texts were included in this anthology and certain texts were excluded from this anthology. Basically, we ask similar kinds of questions to canon formation. I mean, you have a canon of texts. Then somebody has, for whatever reason, said we want to include in the list these texts, and we want at the same time to exclude these others. So you have a whole thing opens up then with regard to the kind of political, economic, social, power politics, whatever, right? That is at the basis of canon formation. It's not the same in anthology, of course, you know, but similar questions can be asked. Therefore, when we talk about the author, we have to be talking about the authors, not necessarily of this whole Brihadaranyaka, but of the sections that we are dealing with, because we are never not sure whether the sections were written by the same person as the anthologist. Right? And even when we are talking about the age of the Upanishads, it's real problematic, because are we talking about the age of the individual pieces in which is included in the anthology, or are we talking about when the anthology was created? And in the case of Brihadaranyaka, it's even more difficult, because there were already probably three existing anthologies which were brought together into a super anthology. Right? So we have all these text layers, you know, that we have to talk about. The reason for Brihadaranyaka is that older Upanishads have a list of vansha, the list of authors, not authors, teachers, I guess, yes, teachers of this doctrine, and it goes, of course, into the mythical layers and down to the more historical, we would say, and we have the vansha attached after each of the four sections, so six chapters, first two chapters vansha, third and fourth vansha, fifth and sixth vansha. So those are the problems that we have with regard to the anthology. With regard to the Brihadaranyaka, which comes from the Yajurveda, the White Yajurveda, Shukla Yajurveda, Shaka, and the Chandogya, which is from the Samaveda. So we have probably two texts that come from different intellectual, social milieus. That's something that Renu has once said, that the story, history of the Veda is the history of the Shakas. We have yet to study closely, because of the lack of information, the history of these Shakas. We think of Shakas merely as texts, because that's all we have from the Shakas. But these were not just texts, but people, you know, living individuals who had their own needs and own biases and own aspirations. So what kinds of social matrix was underlies these texts is an important question to ask. It's not always easy to answer, because we don't have the kind of information that Polly has, for example, when she's studying Maharashtra of the 17th century, which is much easier, you know, than when you're dealing with the 3rd, 4th century before Christ in northern India. But a bit of light has been thrown. I wonder whether you all have seen this new, well, not very new now, book of Johannes Bronckhorst. You know, many of you probably know. Possibly his finest contribution. I read the book with my graduate seminar this semester and brought Johannes down from Lausanne, Switzerland. So he spent a week in Austin, which is nice, to talk about the book. It's called The Greater Magadha. And arguing for a distinct culture in the area of what he calls Greater Magadha. Now, many points in that book are controversial and needs further elucidation and may not always be accurate. But I think he sets out a broad outline of a geographical dimension to our analysis of texts that we have not done in the past. We have tried to say one is earlier, one is later, but this has often no meaning if one is somewhere here and we somewhere here without any connection. When you say earlier and later, we always think that the one has to influence the other in some sense, right? But it doesn't have to, right? And so he has brought in a very serious way, a geographical dimension, which was lacking in earlier studies, except for some works of Michael Witzel, who has done quite a bit with regard to localization of Vedic text and the dialectical variations that you find in the Vedic texts. Johannes's work pertains to a period that is in the middle of the first millennium before Christ, which is so 500, 600, 400 in that period, showing that that this area had a distinctive culture. And one of the most distinctive things that he brings up is the idea of rebirth and karma, which we have generally, our scholars have generally taken as a pan-Indian given, where he problematizes that and tries to say that this may not have been pan-Indian, and that it could have been geographically a regional doctrine, and regionally developed, and especially visible in the early ascetic religions, and asceticism itself being a distinctive feature, probably, at least the Shramana kinds of asceticism being a distinctive feature of this part of India, which is what is today Bihar, yeah. Taking the Jain and the Ajivaka take on the karma theory and the rebirth theory as a sort of indicative of how the rebirth theory began in this part, in this region, and showing how Buddhism, and we asked him, and one problem was that he doesn't deal with Buddhism in the book, and when he gave the talk in Austin, dealt with Buddhism, and he says that Buddhism can be viewed as a reaction to the old ways of conceiving karma and rebirth, and therefore he takes it as a sort of an exceptional thing. It's not indicative of Magadha, especially because Buddhism truly ethicizes and internalizes karma. Karma is no longer an action, but desire or something internal, intentional. So intent is important. So that's where it's quite interesting. So in a sense, coming back then to this, we find that where is the Chandogya located? And that becomes a significant thing. Probably it was a Kuru Panchala text. So we are talking about the heartland of ancient Brahma, which later on Patanjali and later text Manu calls the Aryavarta, which is from the confluence of Yamuna and Ganga, so Allahabad, further east to what would be the Kurukshetra area, right? That kind of thing. So we are talking about a Western text, whereas the Brihadaranyaka was Shukla Yajurveda text, and the Yajnavalkya, as we see in the Brihadaranyaka in other texts, other parts of the Brihadaranyaka, was located in Videha, where Janaka was. And that is, Videha was just north of what would be the Greater Magadha area. So it's an eastern thing, and what you find in chapter 4 of the Brihadaranyaka is this great debate between Yajnavalkya, the representative of Videha, the easterners, with a sort of a new Veda now, Shukla, you know, call it Shukla. Why is it called Shukla? Any other students here? Because it took all the Brahmana portions out of it. And had only the mantras, right? This is actually not so it presents itself as older, you know, without the contamination, but actually it is later. Again, we find by purifying it of the contamination of the Brahmana texts. And it is probably a younger, newer tradition, more what we call a Protestant tradition. And Brihadaranyaka shows how he defeated this, you know, group of Kuru Panchala Brahmins in Janaka's court, public debate. And it ends with poor Shakalya losing his head, literally. His head shattered, which is an interesting theme with Witzel as well as Insula has written on the earth-shattering, head-shattering metaphor, literary trope that you find in many places. But his death, sort of in a sense, the literary conquest or the victory of the Videha over. So this is what you find in the Brihadaranyaka. So you find two very distinct cultural milieus, and two distinct Brahmanical traditions, I think, in this. And the Brihadaranyaka, of course, the centrality of the Yajnavalkya, we talked about, it's a Yajnavalkya document. Brihadaranyaka, of course, is the last section of the Shatapada Brahmana. Shatapada Brahmana, of course, is the longest Brahmana we have, where also Yajnavalkya occurs. And Yajnavalkya is again a very interesting character. He's what you would call sort of he's sarcastic, you know. He's he has sense of irony, and if of all the people that you find in the Upanishads, he's the one I like to meet. You know, that could have been a fun man to have a beer with, and relate to. But one of my students, Stephen Lindquist, actually wrote his dissertation on Yajnavalkya. Again, not taking Yajnavalkya. Yajnavalkya has been worked on by many scholars, mostly to find out what is historically the sayings of Yajnavalkya, as opposed to what has spurious. How one can say what is spurious and what is not is beyond me. So basically what Stephen did was to forget that and take Yajnavalkya as a literary figure and not a historical figure, although there may be a history behind that, and to see how this character has been developed literally through early Shatapatha, through Brihadaranyaka, into the epic Mahabharata, and into later time. You must realize that one of the major Dharmashastras is ascribed to Yajnavalkya. Yajnavalkya Smriti of the 4th, 5th century CE, the Gupta text. So Yajnavalkya is the center of Brihadaranyaka in Videha. And in all likelihood, we find then that Brihadaranyaka omits a text. This is the 6th, I think the 6th chapter of Chandogya, where you have the long discussion that between Uddalaka and Shvetaketu, where Uddalaka asks again the young Shvetaketu, who has come after going to Oxford and getting his degree, and all puffed up and know everything, and he asks this simple question: do you know that, knowing which you know everything? And he says, no, nobody taught me that in Oxford. So he then begins to teach him this, and that's this long 6th chapter of and that's where this famous thing, Tattvamasi, comes, which is very interesting, because as my friend Joel has this wonderful study on Tattvamasi, shows that it doesn't mean anything that Shankara ever took it to be, could not in the Vedic language, because in the Vedic language, actually in Sanskrit in general, the pronoun, the subject-object, you could call it that, or the what we would call in the nominal sentences, what is called the theme and the comment. There's a theme. We are talking about the sun, and we say sun is Brahman, right? So we are talking about the sun, and you say sun is Brahman. And in that, when a pronoun is used, the pronoun that is the object that describes is in the same gender as the pronoun or the person or the thing to which it is ascribed. Okay. So if you want to say that tvam is that, he should have said sa tvamasi. You can't say that. The tat just cannot. Of course, the later interpretation is tat refers to Brahman, which is neuter, right? So it's okay, but it doesn't happen in Sanskrit, and you can't do that. So tat here would, in that things, would have been something like tena or something of that name, meaning in this way. That's how you are. That's how I translate. So it tells a way a person is, but that shows a sort of a very close reading of the text that. Of course, later Indian theology took it a different way, quite appropriately for theology, but we are talking about now what does Uddalaka say, and not what Shankara says. So he omitted the Uddalaka story completely. We could ask why. Clearly, Uddalaka is one of the people who comes as one of the Panchala Brahmins, Guru Panchala Brahmins, in his big debate. Right? And what is more is that in one of the Vamshas, you find that Yajnavalkya is the pupil of Uddalaka. And therefore would have been a classmate of Shvetaketu, if the Vamsha is to be believed. And somehow the Brihadaranyaka is trying to, you know, make light of that and put Uddalaka somewhere there. So Uddalaka never comes in the Brihadaranyaka as a significant teacher, you know, but he does in the Chandogya. And then sometimes, so we can see how the presentation of Uddalaka and Shvetaketu in the Chandogya would be different from its presentation in the Brihadaranyaka. And that's the sort of the thing that I'm trying to do with this long-winded... I thought I had to talk because too many people came here. How the two are therefore different in the presentation of the text, I think. With that, I would like to sort of take a quick look. Do you have your, and we can, we could just go to page 54. I think you all have that, sort of the, you have that? Yeah, and there are some here if nobody has. And this is my sort of attempt to sort of schematically and visually present the dialogue in the three. You have the. Are you all okay? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just to take a. How long do we go on?
Well, we've only got an hour today.
Oh, okay, that's all right. We can continue next. Okay, so there are, and Renata Sonnen has quite conveniently divided this dialogue into three parts. One I have given as A, which is dialogue between Shvetaketu and Jaivali or Chitra, depending on the text, and that goes on till number 18. Those numbering of the text fragments is just mine, so just to make it easier. And then from 19 it becomes the B, dialogue between Shvetaketu and Uddalaka. And then C, which begins at 28, is the dialogue between Uddalaka and Jaivali. Just to recap the story, you find Shvetaketu going to Jaivali. Jaivali asks him some questions. He's unable to answer. He gets all angry and you know, in a huff goes back to his father. And that is the B then. He talks with his father, and that's very brief there. And then the father alone comes back to Jaivali to get the instruction. Now, the instruction is the five fires, which I have not given here because it doesn't contribute really to the story. You know, this is the story is prior to that. We can, of course, you know, read that too at some point. There are clear distinctions between the Chandogya version and the Brihadaranyaka version, even there. So those are the four things. So if you go there, Brihadaranyaka starts, and here I have number one here. Shvetaketurhava Aruneyah Panchalanam Parishadam Ajagama. That's the Brihadaranyaka. Shvetaketu, the son of Aruni, who's the same as Uddalaka, came to the audience hall of the Panchalas, or Parishad. The term is interesting. The word is used even in a legal sense. Legal, meaning a Parishad, meaning a legal assembly. But this seems to be something more akin to a Mantri Parishad, or Parishad of the king. Okay, so that's that. In the Chandogya version, he has Shvetaketur Haruneyah Panchalanam Samitim Eaya. So he uses the word Samiti as opposed to Parishad. What to make of that, we do not know. Could be just a regional variation of names. He uses the word AI, from A plus E came, whereas Bradharanjaya used A plus Gam, which is probably again a regional preference or individual preference. But it's interesting that that the Brihadaranyaka author continues to use the word A Gam as opposed to Chandogya author, who continues to use A E throughout. If you take, for example, number 28, you will see the same difference. Sa ajagama gautamo yatra pravahanasya jayvalayar asa. And when we go to Chandogya, you have saha gautamo ragnyavardham eaya. So it's the same kind of thing. So it's not something just happens, you know, he just happened to use it. It seems there's a certain amount of uniformity in this. No? Okay, so basically this says that the Shvetaketu went to the Parishad of the king of Panchalas, right? And the Panchalas here refers probably to the king of Panchalas, because Panchalas don't have Parishad. When you go to the Kaushitiki, it's quite different. He gives a little story. We don't know why Shvetaketu decided to come to the Parishad. He doesn't say that. He just came. Kaushitiki gives a little background. Chitro Hawaii Gangyayanir. So, name is different now. Yakshamana, he was about to perform a sacrifice from Yaj, future. Present participle. So Yakshyamana Arunim Vavre. Vru is a very technical term to choose a priest. So Arunim means Shvetaketu's father. Okay. He said, okay, I want Arun to come and do my sacrifice. Sa, which is Aruni, her Putram Shvetaketum Prajighaya Yajayeti. So he did not want to go himself. You know, he had other better things to do, I assume, right? But sent his son, Shvetaketu, saying, go and perform the sacrifice. So that was the reason for him to come. So Kaushitiki gives an interesting background, and it makes sense why the king all of a sudden asks questions of this young man, right? Because in the Kaushitiki, as we will see, he was afraid that this fellow didn't know very much. And he wanted to be sure that it's important to employ a priest who knows Javeda, you know, who knows. And he was not very sure that this little guy could do it. You know? So that's the reason why he asked the questions. In Brihadaranyaka and Chandogya, we don't have any of either why he all of a sudden asked all these questions. Okay? I'm sorry, please ask me questions. Okay? Don't let me proceed. Let me stop. Anyone for a...
No one.
Not
do
even Sanjukta.
Do you think it happened not in Mithila or in Videha, but happened in Urupanjala?
Right, that's what at least it this way.
Sort of different story.
Yes, the story is this story is set because Uddalaka Aruni was a Panchala Brahmin, and he went to the king of Panchalas. Mm. He doesn't say what city.
So it is not a west and east confrontation?
No. Right. East and west confrontation is only in the Brihadaranyaka, and that's in the fourth chapter, right? Yes. Yeah. Right. But what this does, I think, in the hands of the Brihadaranyaka author, is to sort of, it's a little bit of a put down of Uddalaka. And this guy, even the son, let alone the son, even the father, didn't know the stuff that the king knew, you know, which is very interesting, you know, and that's, I think, the thing. Now, the whole question about kings knowing things, and this has been talked about a lot in Indology, you know, why is it that very frequently in the Upanishads, you find a doctrine being taught by a king, too, theory had also been put forward that this shows that that some of this Upanishadic thinking may have been fostered in the kings, among royalty and court. I'm not very sure about that. Here we are looking for history in literature, and that's a very dangerous thing always. Yes, it is possible, but it is not necessary that when a story tells that a king taught something, that a king taught something. Mm-hmm. What it does is that the story finds it good to put it this way. Okay, and you must realize that these, after all, who were the authors of Upanishads? Who were the authors of the collections of the Upanishads? Who were the authors of these anthologies? All Brahmins. If they were Brahmins, why would they want to say that the kings knew this and we didn't? So I always think that this is a literary strategy here. What the strategy is not very clear, but clearly it's a strategy, and we have to take it as a literary device rather than as somehow or other an opening or a window into history. My own feeling, and which I've sort of expressed in some in my Ashrama book, is that I think at this time, and we are talking about a time when large empires or large political formations were coming into being in these northern regions of India, it may have been politically expedient for some sects or some groups to say, to align themselves with the powerful. You must realize that the Buddha is given imperial pedigree, right? Mahavira is likewise said to be a son of a king. Who is Krishna? Who is Rama? The great gods of Hinduism, right? Avatars Hindu, they're also kings, not Brahmins. So it's very interesting that all these Brahminical writings are presenting certain kinds of religious doctrines at this time as given by the Brahmins, I think, by kings, I think. And that may have something to do with the political realities of the time rather than, these kings doing this.
But I think the interesting question also is what the kings teach in these stories in the Upanishads. And if I remember correctly, I think that usually it's this knowledge of what happens after death. And therefore, I want to ask you whether you think it's something, that is how we see the Kshatriyas as Tyakta Jivita, so they know what happens after death. They are in battle. They have this kind of knowledge, and therefore the Brahmins assign them to teach this knowledge.
I mean, a close
encounter with death in that sense.
That'll be an interesting project for you to do. To take all the places where a Kshatriya is the teacher, and see whether that holds, because I don't think it holds, because there are many other places, Ashwapati and others. Janaka himself, I mean, look at Janaka. In the Shatapatha Brahman, there's an encounter between Janaka and Yajnavalkya. That's the earliest, first encounter, in which Janaka is riding a horse and encounters this group of Brahmins and asks a question about Agnihotra. And now nothing about Agnihotra. And this guy couldn't do anything. And he sort of laughs and goes away. Yajnavalkya goes after him and gets him to teach him the Agnihotra, okay? The secret of Agnihotra. And later, in the Brihadaranyaka, Yajnavalkya comes back, and of course, he's the big boss then, right? So it's very interesting, two stories that present the relationship between Yajnavalkya and Janaka in very different light. But it's an interesting thing to see whether there is any distinction in the content of the teaching. When it is done by a king as opposed to one done by others, Johannes Bronckhorst also has taken some of these as more historical than I would take, and takes it as somehow or other reflective of the Magadha area, where according to him Brahmanism had not penetrated. Or the Brahmanism as we know it from the West. So in a sense, there's sort of if they were Brahmins, they were sort of Brahmins who were not the same kind as these others. And there was, so therefore, it's an unbrahmanical area. And uses some of this Upanishadic text to show how then the Brahmins were now viewed as learners rather than teachers. It's a problematic thing, but I'm very, very hesitant to read history into literature. Not that there is no history in literature, but to discover history in literature, you have to really excavate. You have to really use kind of sophisticated methods, not saying that on the 15th of August, 1855, this happened. You can take it for sure that it probably didn't happen. You know, exactly the way they want to tell you that it happened that way, right? Then they have something to gain by saying that. So that's what I'm on. I'm always, when a text tells me this is what happened, I'm going to say it probably didn't happen that way. They want us to think that it happened that way, right? Then you ask different kinds of questions from that, right? To get history from text is a difficult thing. It's most difficult because it seems so easy. In archaeology, it's much more difficult because you get bits and pieces of, stuff. You have to sort of then weave a narrative. And that is the difficulty itself makes you careful. Texts are so beguilingly easy. And a lot of people then go and say, hey, Manu says this, so therefore it happened, kind of thing, right? One of my students has been working on the Arthashastra for his dissertation. Arthashastra is an interesting text, of course, because it's one of the few texts that is not completely Brahmanical, I think, although it had a Brahmanical makeover at a particular time, and that's what my student is trying to do. But it's very interesting that the whole theory of Varna doesn't come in that, except in places where you immediately see a later Brahmanical hand, right? That's very interesting, and what Mark McLeish, my student, is trying to say is that whenever the term Varna is used in any text, the Brahmins try to present it as a descriptive term. It describes what is social reality, but we have always take it as a prescriptive term. In other words, it's an ideological term where it presents the society as it should be, and therefore it's Brahmanical advantage there. I think you have to be very, very careful about that. It's very interesting. I've been working now because we're having this big conference on Ashoka in Delhi on the 5th to 7th of August, working on that, and I'm working on a little study on the inscriptions of Ashoka. And what I'm trying to do, quite different, but from Upanishads, but very interesting because I'm trying to see Ashokan inscriptions not as edicts but as texts. And because they were all written together, at least the rock edicts and the pillar edicts, as anthologies again, just like this, and ask the kind of questions. What I want to say is that the word Varna doesn't occur even once in this whole text, right? When the word Brahmana comes, they are for the most part presented as a kind of religious group rather than as a sociologically identifiable social group. This is very interesting. So what I'm trying to say again in this long-winded answer to you is that texts, one has to be very, very careful to get history out of it. Yes, Paul?
Kind of picking up on this, which I found tremendously interesting, that being not an Indologist or a Sanskritist. In a way, what you're saying suggests that there can be a kind of intermediate level of looking for historical things in these texts, because if I can put it crudely, what you're suggesting about this text, and it makes sense with some of the later texts that I've been looking at for the 17th century, is that at one level it constitutes a kind of a recognized arena within which different people tell stories about one another. Yeah. Which does seem to be a position really very far removed from the older, colonial and modern Indological notion that what we're trying to do is find the oldest, the most authentic. So I guess my question here for this particular text is whether in any, because what one of the things that seems to be happening here is that a newer center of Brahmin learning is telling stories that that are kind of derogatory of an older center of Brahmin learning.
Right.
One of the things that comes up in my later material that I've started to be interested in is the way in which some stories like this are at one level, one of the things they're doing is arguing about what makes a person a Brahmin.
Absolutely.
And I just wondered whether in this story, with this sense that at one level one, you know, that there are still kind of frontiers beyond which Brahmanical culture hadn't really spread, and there are older and newer centres of Brahmin learning, and clearly here one has an issue about generational difference, as well as the Brahmin Kshatriya thing, and as well, you know, as well as a sense of boundaries between people who are Brahmins and people who are not.
Right.
But from what you say in here, there doesn't seem to be any basic questioning, at least overtly,
right,
of the category of Brahmin. You know, that you can't be, that there's not an implication here that, you know, a Brahmin, that the category of Brahmin is in any way
challenged,
open to question,
right,
in a way that it becomes in later texts.
Yes. Yes. I don't think in these Upanishads, I can think of right now off the top of my head, any place where somebody said, you're not a Brahmin,
yeah,
right? Now, the question is, are you a true Brahmin, which
yeah.
is, meaning, do you have the right knowledge?
But that isn't that sort of the same question?
Yes, it is. It is.
Yeah,
exactly. You are challenging the credentials.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because the word, very interestingly, the term that you find in Sanskrit is the word bandhu. Mm?
Right.
When you add the term bandhu to anything, it shows somebody who is that in name only. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, in this text we have Rajanya Bandhu. It's always a derogatory term.
Mm-hmm.
You know? That royal fellow, you know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, who's really not, you know,
yeah.
so claims to be, but Brahma Bandhu is another one. Quite frequently you find he's a Brahmin only name, you know, doesn't know anything, he has not been really, you know, educated. So that is there, which could, I guess, at a particular time, you know, in other words, what does it mean to be a Brahmin? What are the Brahminical privileges, right? You can check
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
And then, which means the, you know, economic gain through various kinds of activities, right? To be in the service of various royalties, and especially, I think, yeah, I mean, there are many ways in which, in later times, you find various kinds of legal, what my students has called the Brahminical exceptionalism, which sort of derives from the American exceptionalism as category comes in the America is always the exception, you know, to everything else. So you can't treat America the same way as you treat other nations. So you have a Brahminical exceptionalism. So the Brahmin is not subject to the death penalty. Brahmin is not subject to taxes. You can go down the list. Arthashastra is completely silent on this. The question then is, and then There are some questions being asked. Are all Brahmins subject to Brahminical exceptionalism or certain kinds of Brahmin?
Yeah.
Is it a Kshatriya, you know, who is a learned Brahmin? So there's whole questions about the privileges of Brahmin. Likewise, in the Maharashtra of the 17th, 18th century, you know, we have this common student who works on the Brahminical identity of this time. You find that some people are called Trikarma Brahmins. Meaning that the Brahmin who is allowed to do only three karmas rather than the six the Brahmins are allowed. You're allowed to sacrifice, you're allowed to sacrifice yourself, but not to officiate sacrifices. You're allowed to receive gifts, to give gifts, but not to receive gifts. You're allowed to learn, but not to teach, right? Those are six. So the everywhere where there's an economic possibility, you are denied that, right? So the Brahmin, so it's very interesting, I think.
But in a way, that example can work the other way around, in that the group of Brahmins who really fell foul of those arguments, of course, are the Saraswats.
Yes.
And here you get, you know, much more overtly social qualifications coming in. So one of the things that Saraswats are always criticised for, two things: one is they ate fish, but the other is that not very many of their people were actually practising sacrifices. You know, that they were clerical people,
yeah,
they were administrators,
right,
they were Laukika Brahmins, if you like.
Yeah.
And looking at those 17th century debates, it's, you know, the privileges of being a Brahmin are one thing, but what goes into determining really who is a Brahmin appears to be, there are really quite a lot of complicated indices.
There's quite a lot of that. And then the mythology comes into it too. I mean, how do you tell a story about how you came into being, you know?
Exactly.
All
that's
the Sahyadrikanda and all that
exactly
of the Skanda Purana that
yeah
you get. Yeah, right. All of that.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else? Anyone? Well, here. We're almost there, I think.
Yes, I think we are, yes.
Yeah. We can do one more, probably, before you leave. Two. Okay, and you say, Sivapa, in the Brihadaranyaka we have this very interesting statement, Sa Ajagama, Ajagama, Jaivalim Pravahanam. So he went to the Parishad, and he went further, Ajagama is the second time, right, to Jaivali Pravahana, who is the king. Then he is said to be Paricharaya Manam. This is not found in any of the other texts. Paricharya Manam, I have given it, I think, somewhere. I write it down here. On page 58, those who have it can take. Paricharya Manam is something like being waited upon. But this, the word Parichar is very interesting. Because in non-causative forms, the verbs are used regularly with regard to the service of putting firewood into the fire. A clearly sexual meaning is attached to the term in the only other occurrence of a causative form. In the Katha Upanishad, death promises Nachiketas, lovely girls of a sort unobtainable by men, when he goes to the afterlife. I'll give them to you, he says, you will have them wait on you, paricharayasva. So what lovely girls do to a man seems to be a term that is parichar. For example, and Satyachama Jabala, another interesting man, when he was a boy, asked his mother, who he had no father, saying, ask his father, tell me about my gotra, you know, wherever, because I want to go and study. And he says, I do not know your gotra. He says, I had him when I was a maid, and tells the boy that and had many relationships. Bahu aham charanti paricharini. Again, the paricharini comes in. So she was a maid, went from house to house, and had many relationships. And the boy was born through this. And he says, you are my daughter, you call him Jabala. He was Jabali. And so he took the name of the mother rather than the father. So the paricharya manam, interesting. It appears to me, and this is how I have interpreted it, you know, somewhat going on a limb, is that it shows that this guy, Shvetaketu, didn't have manners. He barged into the king at an appropriate time. Either there's a sexual connotation because he was having all his women around, you know, or, if you don't want to take that, but at least he was being waited upon by people, maybe at a meal or whatever. So already we set the scene in the Brihadaranyaka saying that Shvetaketu is really not an educated or what do you call it, cultured person, both in the area of, you know, learning as well as in the other areas. Okay, let's stop.
Great, thank you. Yeah,
thank you.
We'll carry on next time.
By the way, next Wednesday I won't be here.
That's right. And
could
we
do it another day, Monday or Tuesday?
Yes, can we change the time? I can't remember what it was now.
Monday.
Monday, yes.
At what time?
11 o'clock.
Same time?
Okay. So do come back at Monday at 11, everyone, and we'll carry on.
Yes.
So thank you, Patrick, for the first session.
Oh, don't need to. Thank you.